the climate movement actually has some really significant wins, but we don't have anywhere to talk about them. I think that we're leaving learning, and I think we're leaving power on the ground. And so I think part of that is to facilitate horizontal relationships and lateral conversations across a movement that, as Jack said, is increasingly vibrant and rich.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guests today, Jack, Joe, and Lindsay Smithson Stanley, work in different capacities with the Climate Advocacy Lab. We discussed that lab, their work, and the blueprint that they've put together for better coalition work within the climate space. And if you're listening to this as it comes out, Jack and Lindsay are helping progressive activists take their blueprint for multiracial cross-class climate movement a step further through a series of free online trainings on how to develop stronger, healthier coalitions after this weekend. Their first session on building the coalition will take place Monday, April 8th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Find out more details and sign up at climateadvocacylab.org or contact Jack. Jack@climateadvocacylab.org. They are interesting people doing good work. You should listen. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Jack and Lindsay at Climate Advocacy Lab.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
So Jack and Lindsay, welcome. Lindsay, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography, and then we'll follow that with Jack?
Absolutely. My name is Lindsay Smithson Stanley. I was born and raised in Missouri. I went to journalism school there, and immediately it became clear to me that my favorite kind of reporting was about environmental issues. So I did that for a couple of years and then started to ask kind of, okay, well, I'm writing these stories. What's the impact that that's having on the people who are reading them? And so I went to school at Carolina, and I have a master's degree in mass communication research. And that's where I kind of fell in love with social science. When I got done was right after Waxman Markey. There was a lot of money being put into the climate space and some real questions about environmental communication that were being raised. And through a total fluke, someone called the wrong person at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I ended up getting connected to a person who would become my boss at an organization called Climate Nexus. So that organization was started in 2011, really about making more explicit and more clear the connection between the impacts of climate and really connecting that with reporters and helping them feel empowered and comfortable talking about the science. I then worked for the National Audubon Society. I was there when we launched the Climate Initiative, which came out after, shocker, they did some research that showed that climate change is bad for birds too. We had developed an engagement strategy about what it meant to bring, in particular, birders who identify as conservative into the space as climate advocates. And it was there that I think I started encountering a lot of the challenges that you talk about on the podcast in terms of how do we take people who perhaps come to an issue through a hobby or an interest, and how do we politicize them? And how do we take people who perhaps don't see themselves as advocates, how do we empower them to be advocates? And while I was wrestling with some of these at Audubon, someone gave me Hari Hahn's How Do Organizations Develop Activists. So I developed very intense academic crush on Professor Hahn. And I knew that I wanted to go back to school because, again, I'm a social science nerd. And so I did a couple years more consulting. I worked with the Yale Program for Climate Change Communication and a startup called the Center for Climate Integrity. And then I came back to school. Right now, I'm a fifth-year student in the political science PhD program, and I'm a student of Professor Hari Hahn. I know that you know her. I'm a member of her research lab, the P3 Research Lab. I'm growing my practice of engaged research, or a kind of social science that works in partnership with organizations working on the ground, so that when we ask and answer research questions, we develop those together in such a way that we move forward their practice and the academic literature. And so kind of those are the two great loves of my life, right? The climate movement and social science. And so through all of the jobs that I've been telling you about, I was a member of the Climate Advocacy Lab. So I was consistently using their resources as a consultant. I led some projects there were about data and aligning our data across the climate advocacy space. And so Jack and I have known each other for years through that. I'm very excited, Jack, that you thought of me when all these questions about coalitions were coming up. But in general, I study the relational aspects of movements, right? So in particular, kind of the negotiations and strategic discussions that take place between organizations, funders, and consultants. And I'm particularly interested in collective learning and collective identity. So those are the questions that I'm exploring in my dissertation, separate from this work.
That's cool. You know, I think without this podcast and the interviews I've done with Hari Han, for example, and Tony at the Yale Center for Climate Communication, and Jeff Nesbitt, was he there at Climate Nexus? And just like as you're going through your career, I'm thinking, well, I touched that slightly for an hour at one point. I guess I can understand a little bit. But it sounds like you've had an interesting career and you're on your way to pretty interesting academic study or close to done with it at this point, right?
From your lips to God's ears. Yep. So I'm in data collection. So this morning I was doing interviews for my dissertation. That's kind of the question. And I know you've touched on this with Hari is, are there spots in formal academia for people to do the kind of research that I think Jack and I really, really value? Or does that mean stepping out of academia, but using all the tools of social science? And that's kind of an ongoing debate and question that I'm exploring right now.
Well, I didn't get as far as you. I made it through my exams and a PhD program and my coursework, but I left and remain undoctored to this day.
Well, if you ever want to go back, I will be your cheerleader, I promise you. But boy, do I understand why you left now.
You know, it is a long road, like many career roads. I'm persistent in other areas, let's just say. Jack, would you mind introducing yourself also and giving me your brief biography?
Sure. So my name is Jack Jo. I'm a social scientist at the Climate Advocacy Lab. I was raised in San Francisco, California. Spent my childhood in the Bay Area, in the city. And I would say that I was kind of, you know, just kind of an aimless, well-meaning, kind of mischievous young man. I spent last weekend with my parents and they were telling my fiance about all the various antics, I guess, I got up to that I don't remember anymore. I was just kind of like going through middle school, going through high school, didn't really have a sense of what I wanted to do or what I was interested in. And then I took an AP environmental science class that really changed my life. And it activated a lot of more latent values and thoughts and concerns that I've had, you know, building in my life that I wasn't really able to direct in any one way. And particularly, I think this was around the early heyday of climate change as a public issue. So like around 2004. And I got really into climate change, more than just the science of climate change, which was certainly really interesting. It was a little bit of, okay, well, let's do something about this now. We've identified this problem. Now let's figure it out. What's next? It was around the time of Inconvenient Truth and the IPCC third report. It seemed like this is a big problem. A lot of people are concerned about it. We have, you know, some level of public consciousness and public outroar about this. So let's do it. And then trying to untangle, why aren't we doing it? What's getting in the way? So ended up at college at Berkeley, basically created my own major and made everything about climate change, even classes on like history post-World War II, like let's make it about climate change. So really kind of looking at this from a bunch of different angles. And I think that that interdisciplinarity really drove how I went about researching and studying this issue, which was not so much about like using the tools of any specific discipline or framework, but more trying to like just answer this question from whatever frameworks I could find available to me. And that did lead me into a PhD program at Duke University at the Nicholas School of the Environment. And I came in, I have the words for it now. I probably didn't have the words for it back then, but more doing probably more environmental sociology work, more critical analysis. And it turns out that Duke did not have a great it was not necessarily a nurturing environment for that, but it did lead me to other avenues, which to answer these questions of why do people think the way they do about climate change? And in particular, what keeps them from taking action? Why do we see such powerful skepticism or inaction or uncertainty around this issue? And became a researcher focusing on political communication, political psychology, and started trying to answer these questions this way of looking into the information environment around climate and finding ways how to pull the public in, how to engage them in meaningful ways, and how to keep them engaged in a consistent way over time, such that, you know, these are not kind of one-time interactions with advocacy or with climate action, but that this becomes part of a habitual sense of what they do, what they value. People are concerned about this. And so they actually want to, you know, spend time really thinking about it and really working to alleviate this concern for themselves. And that led me to the lab. So a little bit the other way around from Lindsay, where I started very much in academia. And then when I was going through my PhD program, I feel like a lot of people in my generation in academia were, do I want to stay in academia or do I not? I played jump rope with that line over and over again. And for me, it was that I felt like I wanted to do more active work, that I didn't want to just teach and study and research and publish things that would be locked up in journals that people wouldn't have access to, but I wanted to actually see if I could have my own impact on the movement. And so ended up joining up this great organization that I'm still part of now called the Climate Advocacy Lab. And I believe you interviewed our former executive director, Sean Kosofsky, a number of years ago, pre-pandemic, about ways to translate some of this knowledge from the social sciences, from academia, mix that in with the knowledge that's being generated in the field, which is plentiful, and patch that in ways that people can understand and use to power up and improve their own campaigns, improve their own advocacy work at whatever scale, from the national to the very, very local. So merge all of my loves of research, of education, of training, of just trying to help people untangle this question of how do we do the work that we do better? How do we save money, save time, save our mental health, and also treat each other more kindly and with more patience and all that?
Thanks, Jack. I did learn a fair amount about the Climate Advocacy Lab from Sean back in 2020 and reviewed that transcript before interviewing you guys so that I would remember more of it. Could you do me a favor, since you've worked there and you've worked there for almost 6 years now, could you describe broadly what the lab does and then maybe update me on how you think things have changed since I talked to Sean?
Yeah, absolutely. So the lab started, and this was before my time, but the lab started as a project of the Skoll Global Threats Fund, which was based on some of the concerns of this philanthropist, Jeff Skoll, and climate change was one of these global concerns, along with, I believe, nuclear proliferation, pandemics, water scarcity, which are certainly all still very present concerns right now, but also climate change and how to get the public more engaged in climate change and what's getting in the way of that. So I think it started off as a way to try to deliver a view of climate change as a political problem that was grounded in social science research from political science, communication, psychology, sociology, and deliver that to advocates, as well as this framework for thinking about evidence-based advocacy. So, you know, instead of just doing things because it's tradition or it's the way that our org has always done things, really taking apart and examining some of those assumptions and figure out if there are better ways for us to be doing our work, whether that's on the tactical level in terms of messaging or on the strategic level when it comes to organizing or not organizing. We also housed a bunch of really cool tools, including the Yale Climate Opinion Maps, based on research from the Yale Project Climate Change Communication, as well as George Mason's Center for Climate Change Communications Centers. They do the Six Americas study. And so we had all these tools, we had all these resources, and we had some advocates that we were able to get out in front of, but we were never very public, and it was much more word of mouth. So the lab spun out, and now that we were independent, figured out, okay, we want to be a movement support organization. We want to support climate advocates, clean energy, and climate justice advocates writ large, but we're not really accessing everyone and not everyone's accessing us, even though we have, we believe, a lot of value to provide. And so what are ways that we can reach people a little bit closer to where they are? And around the time of the pandemic also, right, so that turned into a lot more training-based work, especially as a lot of other trainers in the movement space started kind of closing down shop for one reason or another. And so we really stepped up our training base. We have developed much more of a communal sense. So started a little bit last year, a community Slack for people to engage with each other rather than just our members, of which we have, I think, like 4,000 plus now, individual climate advocates, just asking us questions and asking us for advice. People can ask each other and learn from each other's expertise as well, and provide other ways to kind of access parts of the movement that we did not have a ton of visibility into, such as environmental justice and climate justice spaces, where, you know, we had some relationships, but we needed to build more in order to get out in front of these people that we thought could really benefit from some of the knowledge and services that we provide. And so we've also spent some time really thinking and trying to build relationships with specific partners in these spaces that we feel have good perspectives, have good analyses on the climate issue, have good perspectives on how to build power in the climate space, and trying to work a little bit more in depth with them as well. So going from like this much more kind of pie in the sky, 30,000 view kind of consultant space to trying to be a little bit more on the ground and meeting folks where they are.
Lindsay, since most of your interaction, it sounds like, with the lab has been from an external relationship, how do you see their place in the climate movement? What do you think of them from your position?
I think when I first started leveraging the lab's resources, I thought of it as kind of a distribution and consumer model, right? That they were synthesizing existing research for me. And like Jack said, they were making it manageable as someone who was leading programs and had limited time, that they were distributing it in ways that I could digest it. And that was the case. But I think as I've moved into different positions as part of programs myself, that I think that we have to talk about like the role of the convener. The climate movement actually has some really significant wins, but we don't have anywhere to talk about them. I think that we're leaving learning, and I think we're leaving power on the ground. And so I think part of that is to facilitate horizontal relationships and lateral conversations across a movement that, as Jack said, is increasingly vibrant and rich. I think of it now as a two-way conversation. The coalition's report is in part a response to questions that what we were hearing, not just in climate, but in other sorts of progressive spaces about how do we do this in ways that work, right? I think of them now as a place where you can surface, here's what I still don't understand. And then I think the lab is quite good at saying, here's what we know and how we know it, and getting folks comfortable with the language of evidence and getting folks comfortable agitating inside your organization to actually say, well, can you tell me why do you do that? And if it is indeed the case, well, because that's always how it's been done, here's some evidence that I'd like to talk about otherwise, right? So I think of them as being able to say, here's what we know about that question or that challenge, right? Be it both strategic or tactical. And then what else do we need to know to best serve you?
Lindsay, to follow up on that, I'm not terribly knowledgeable about the climate movement space. I've talked to some of the people we've mentioned. I've talked back in the day to the founder of like Sunrise Movement, which is at one end of sort of a direct action. I've talked to people in big environmental groups. Understanding from the 4,500 people who you say are members of this lab, there are lots of organizations of lots of different sizes, some which are totally focused on climate, some which climate is part of a much broader portfolio. Could you help me understand, like, how many meaningful organizations are there in this space? What's like a modal size? What's the distribution of size? What does it look like when you look across all of these entities? Because I think I'm suspecting that it's going to be a lot like a lot of other parts of the progressive ecosystem, that we are an armada of many different ships of many different sizes that are sometimes well coordinated and sometimes less so. But tell me what you see.
Sure. I think the Armada is an excellent metaphor. We do have to recognize that for the history of the United States, there have always been two environmental movements. One that we might describe as mainstream or kind of legacy that were coming out of some of the civil disobedience and the advocacy of the 1960s, right? And contributing to some of those wins. And at the same time, they were much more local and led by marginalized communities and people of color that was not necessarily around emissions reduction, but around public health, right? The environmental justice movement. And those were always going at the same time. So when I think about the movement now, I think that one, that there is much more blending of those two kinds of organizations, right? And then I think it's important that what you say is we have folks working at every level of analysis. We still do have a cadre of, I think at this point we could say long in the tooth organizations, right? That operate here.
At 58, I object already to that characterization of mature and experienced and wise.
That's fair. Absolutely fair. Who are often asking questions of federal policy and federal advocacy strategy, right? Thinking about what are the big levers, be they legislative or executive action. That is also true. And many of those organizations, and I think some of the best successes have been at the state level, where in some cases, you absolutely heard of coalitions that included organizations that are things like the Sierra Club in the NRDC, and were bolstered by much more dynamic coalitions, like you said, that might not have been folks who describe themselves as climate advocates, but came to the issue of climate through a different pathway, right? And that includes these hyper-local efforts. I don't want to sound naive in the sense that there is absolutely strategic disagreement. There is absolutely still competition for resources. But I do think it's fair to say that the movement is much more dynamic and it is diverse, not only in the people who comprise it, but like you said, the types of organizations that exist. In terms of thinking big picture about organizing, we should also, that I think that the lab is one of these kind of, some people call them intermediary institutions, right? I think that that's how Tony describes the YCCC, as kind of these entities, right, that come about to fill a particular hole or a particular capacity gap that we see. And I think that's a real active discussion for those of us who are activists is when does it make sense to do those? Because in some cases, some organizations are ready to close down. I'll stop there. I love your metaphor, and it is absolutely a multi-layered and incredible, frustrating, and invigorating and wonderful place to work.
Jack, you shared with me in advance of this conversation, a blueprint that the two of you worked on. I see you as co-authors alphabetically, so who knows what that means. It is two different documents. What is the, what I would call the founding story for doing this? Who commissioned it? Did you come up with it? What were you trying to accomplish? What did you produce and why?
It'll be one very run-on sentence. We started at the lab trying to build out this project of, okay, what are we hearing from our members that seems to be holding them back from building multiracial cross-class power in the climate movement? And so in a lot of ways, that is going beyond the bounds of traditional mainstream legacy, however you want to say it, environmental groups, which are, this is painting with a broad brush, but generally fairly white, well-off, older crowd, but trying to create...
Mature, Jack. Mature.
Oh, mature. I'm sorry.
I think they've changed a fair amount over time, but yes, I know what you're talking about.
So I would say the current political moment has moved away from climate policy being carbon absolutism, right? Where we just care about the amount of tons that are emitted or not emitted. And so the mechanisms or the policies that were really very in vogue were those that, you know, dealt with carbon as kind of a countable commodity, right? So like carbon taxes, carbon cap and trade schemes, and these different ways of kind of quantifying carbon or greenhouse gas emissions. And even if there were nods to social benefits or economic benefits or household financial benefits, the main benefit, right, was based on just reducing carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gas emission. The paradigm has really changed. I think a lot of ways I credit Sunrise for doing this, right, around popularizing this phrase of Green New Deal and this idea that it can't just be about carbon. It can't just be about emissions or gases. It has to be about people and the ways that people can benefit from climate policy and all the other ways.
With all that in mind, where did this come from? What triggered the start of this? And what's the story there? Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Thank you. I'll cut the chase. So over the last decade, but certainly the last like 4 or 5 years, I think there's been a growing increase in coalitions. And we hear this from our members like, hey, our supporters want us to get into coalition. We've been invited to join this coalition, or our funders are telling us to get into this coalition or whatever. But coalition work is hard. Coalitions are really frustrating. We feel like we understand why people want to do coalitions, but we don't really know how to do coalitions well or make coalition work easier. And when we were looking around for answers to that problem, we did not really find too much in the space of how to do coalition work in effective ways, to say nothing of healthy, equitable ways. And that lens became even more important for us because the climate movement has become much more diverse in terms of race, in terms of class, in terms of different perspectives coming into this problem, that how do we coordinate our effort better so that the armada is sailing in one direction and ships are not careening into each other, or, you know, some ships are just taking a U-turn every now and then and just going the other way.
Or firing at each other.
Or firing at each other, or burning each other down, or dragging each other back, or whatever metaphor he'd like to use there. But yeah, certainly coalitions can be hard. And coordinating across different perspectives, different political analyses, different theories of change can be very hard. And so that's what this project was how do we understand modern multiracial cross-class climate coalitions, the dynamics, the concepts that are necessary to run them well? So that's kind of in the report, which is based on lit review, case study analysis, a bunch of expert interviews that we did with coalition members and participants and designers. And then we created a workbook that's how to take some of these lessons and insights from this research and actually try to apply that into your coalition, whether this is one that's already off the ground or you're building right now or whatever, and how to create healthier, more equitable, more effective coalitions so that we can actually make good on the political promise of coalition work.
That sounds like a worthwhile endeavor. Lindsay, how'd you get roped into this?
So we should note that even outside the climate space, that our lab P3, the lab that Hari Han runs at Johns Hopkins, we were getting questions about coalitions from both partners on the ground with whom we had done research projects and funders. And so this was already a conversation, and questions about coalitions were percolating and surfacing in P3. And in fact, that spring, I believe it was spring 2022, Jack, P3 did a synthesis of the academic literature, not only political science, but sociology. We looked a lot at the business management and other kind of different social sciences, right? And did a synthesis of that literature. So thankfully, through my work on that, I had kind of been steeped in what the scholarship said, right? And I think Jack knows I'm always a willing nerd. And so I got roped into it when he said, we're hearing those questions. And I was able to say, oh my God, these questions are beyond climate. We need to answer them. And I was in a good position to have the tools to do it.
Mike, I'm just going to guess that P3 stands for possible, probable, powerful.
You know, I think you have a really good memory for the brand. I think you're exactly right.
So you two joined forces. Did you have resources? Did you have other help? How did you go about, after having this work already started in a certain sense at P3, how'd you go about it within the climate lab?
So this was a project that was born out of some internal conversations in the Climate Advocacy Lab from our 2021, 2022 strategic planning kind of thing, which is we wanted to really take a deep look inside and figure out what are the ways that we can provide real value to the community and to the movement. And we decided, okay, this is one way that we can create something that hasn't been created that people are asking for. And I wanted to bring in someone with really great qualitative case analysis chops who has, you know, great experience in the space. Lindsay was absolutely my first choice here. I was so happy when Lindsay said that, yes, she had time for this.
That's why your dissertation's not done yet, you realize.
There we go, Nathaniel. There we go. Just poke the bear. Poke the bear.
Well, the other thing is that we had in piecemeal already a couple of these case studies written up from the groups that landed the Portland Clean Energy Fund, the Illinois coalition that worked on CEJA, the Clean and Equitable Jobs, the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, from New York Renews, the coalition that got the CLCPA. And if you want to look, if someone wants to look up what that acronym is, doesn't come to mind right now. But these really incredible pieces of, you know, big policy wins at the state level, at the local level. And so we had all these individual elements already of case studies that were built. It's like, what can we also learn from these things that we have? What do we need to go out and get more of in order to have a vision for this overall problem and some recommendations for how to solve these problems?
Lindsay, who should read this blueprint and the blueprint workbook? Who's your hoped for audience, and what will they get out of it if they do?
Sure. I have several, shocker. So my primary would be folks who, I think, as Jack said, have recognized that it does not matter how old or how well-funded, no wins can be won or secured with a single group anymore. That's just not possible given the political realities of today, right? So my first audience would be climate advocates who recognize the potential and also the perils of coalition work, right? In particular, I think at the state and local levels. We can come back to what that looks like nationally, but I think we had a real eye on those kind of sub-levels. And then my second one is, I really want to get it in front of funders, because I think that our advocates on the ground had so much to say about the kinds of resources and at what point in the campaign trajectories they needed those resources that really that surprised me. And you've heard I've been in this space a really long time. And so I think one is, I think it's an excellent collection to see what works and then to be very honest about the challenges that groups faced on the ground and to really agitate funders to say, we continue to nudge people towards this as the vehicle for change, but we forget that that might require additional support or a different kind of capacity building. And then my pie in the sky would be also that maybe that some folks like us who have interest of asking, like, how can the tools of social science, you know, be used to move organizing forward? I would love for them to read it. And we have a discussion about whether we think it's a good example of that, right? There's always a tension between how do we make our advocates on the ground feel empowered because there's evidence behind everything we've written. There's hundreds of citations in there. But how do we also make it accessible for people who have limited time and capacity? Right. And so that's where the second component of the workbook comes in. And one additional point is that I think there's a real temptation in our space to have a checklist or to call for a checklist or to call for a set of to-dos. And working in the P3 lab has really made it clear to me that everything that we do is a craft. And so I'm particularly interested in folks' response to how we set up the workbook as a set of questions that coalitions need to ask themselves. We do give some advice on the answers, and we're honest about here's what advocates told us went well or created threats and problems. But the important thing is that it is a set of questions for people who are actively trying to work with other organizations to build power for climate solutions.
Jack, you want to add on to that?
We don't want to only say that this is for people to like start up a brand new coalition or build from scratch, right? That people who are currently working in coalitions that, you know, are diverse, especially along lines of race and class, that they should also be looking at the report and looking at the workbook for potential resource in terms of course correction, in terms of facilitation. If there are currently things that they're unhappy about in how their coalition runs, we provide some tools for troubleshooting as well. So not just for building new things, but also taking a look at things that already exist.
Lindsay, I know that Hari and people who work with her are interested in other areas of organizing beyond climate. Is the template of what you've done here in terms of how to operate better coalitionally in climate applicable to other areas of progressive organizing?
Absolutely. The only thing that are climate specific is some of the moments when we learn about policy and how coalitions had to navigate policy decisions, like at the very final moments of negotiating a bill, right? I have absolutely every confidence that the challenges that came out of this report from coalition work and some of the pathways that we hope folks can frame it are absolutely applicable. It might be the case that for different issues, the content of the disagreement might look sort of different, right? About what kind of tripwires we see certain policy components. But it is absolutely the case that they can anticipate similar challenges and similar the necessity of negotiation across a coalition, regardless of issue.
The only thing I would add to what Lindsay said is that we can be a little bit more specific here in that every coalition, regardless of issue or topic or who's involved, needs to be thinking about, okay, well, what's our vision? What is our shared vision together? And how do we want to agree to work with each other? What does that mean, right? So in the blueprint that we put out, we talk about what it means to build clarity, what it means to build trust, how to navigate conflict, how to build in processes and structures such that people can understand where to get information, how to stay updated, as well as if something goes wrong, what do we do next? So those are, to me, incredibly agnostic of issue area or anything like that. These are just like matters of like breaking through assumptions, making the implicit explicit, and trying to eliminate miscommunications.
Lindsay, you mentioned that this blueprint and other things that happen at Climate Advocacy Lab put them in a position of being a convener in the climate space or having the opportunity to do more things to allow people to work better together. Are there competing conveners? Are there competing hubs? Would people happily view Climate Advocacy Lab in that role? What's the politics of that aspect of things?
Sure. I don't think that there is a direct competitor to the Climate Advocacy Lab because it's not set up as a consulting relationship. It could be the case that some climate organizations are paying a consulting group or some other advisor to work through some of the questions that the Climate Advocacy Lab...
I mean, in terms of the convener aspect or the hub aspect, less the, you know, someone else trying to do the work that they do, but it sounds like almost an expansion of the vision for the lab to be that coordinator. That's probably a useful thing to have. I just don't know, and I'm asking out of curiosity, what's going on there?
So I don't think it's a coordinator. I don't hold the lab accountable for making sure that the ships are traveling in the same general direction. I think of the lab as helping to just torture this metaphor, right? To give the boats every possible tool in their arsenal.
Just so that they can proceed more weatherworthy and faster and
there
things like
go.
That. Yeah, to continue to torture it, yeah.
You asked this question about conveners is interesting because I do think that there are ongoing conversations at the national and often at the state level where organizations are coming together to what I think Jack and I would not describe as a coalition. They're coming together to say, what are you doing? Okay, well, what are your policy priorities? And there's discussions. And I describe that as coordination, right? That is not collective effort toward a collective goal, right? Nor is it kind of what the lab is doing, which is equipping folks with just more information to make more strategic choices.
Jack, when I think about the political challenge of climate action and protecting our country and the world from worsening problem. I hate to think that one of the problems is within the movement that's trying to do this. I mean, any human endeavor has challenges. Even two people in a marriage have trouble coordinating, much less people across the movement. But I would imagine without being close to it, that the economic incentives, the companies that benefit by selling fossil fuels, the political actors that have figured out how to be climate deniers and have somehow taken over one of the political parties to some extent, like that would be a far bigger challenge than getting everybody in this movement to operate a little bit better. How do you view the bigger politics of climate right now?
A colleague of both Lindsay and me, Matt Mildenberger, and his co-author, Michael Acklin, I hope I'm saying that right, they wrote this great piece a couple years ago about how climate change and climate policy has historically been framed as a collective action problem, right? So this problem of free riders. And, you know, we need to get everyone on board. It can't just be the US or it can't just be California. It has to be China and India and Brazil and all that. And they instead reframe climate policy as a distributive conflict. Who are the winners and losers of any climate policy? And there are some very, very powerful potential losers of climate policy, right? In terms of what you're saying, very moneyed, resourced economic interests, people who have ideological interest in not dealing with climate change for whatever reason, and it can be very daunting for sure. And so what people who want to create good climate policy ideas need to be thinking about is how do we create a redistribution of those winners of policy, right? How do we create more winners such that we can build a critical mass that outbalances those potential losers?
Winners could be allies.
Yes, and winners can be allies. And that's one way that coalitions, right, especially nowadays, are working, where it's not just traditional climate groups, but working also with labor unions, with organized labor, right, with environmental justice, with racial justice, with indigenous rights groups, farm workers, to create this larger basis for winners of policy and to be able to organize those bases and communicate to those bases why X and Y policy will benefit you, how this will be good for us, how this helps the concerns that we already have and, you know, winds us into a larger vision. And that's, I think, the real kind of political struggle in a larger macro view of trying to collect these different interests that maybe have not seen themselves as having a common interest, but actually saying, oh, no, we all care about this together because this policy idea has provisions for all of us to benefit from, and we can build this larger political power base that can outweigh those of our opposition.
Speaking of opposition, Lindsay, has anyone studied to a great extent the organizing going on the other side that is counter to Green New Deal, obviously, counter to carbon taxes, counter to climate advocacy, as you guys help facilitate? What's the state of that side?
So let's go from kind of the general to the super specific. Is I think Theda Skocpol and Alexander Hertel Fernandez have done some great work comparing the capacity of like donor and strategy networks on the left and the right, and the ability to put the armada in a shared direction. So there's some great work going on there. But then moving down to climate specifically, if you think about probably the last 15 years, we've had a lot of journalism, investigative journalism, that surfaced just how nefarious Big Oil was, in particular about what it knew about climate change, right? So that journalism is providing a basis for what we see now with some of the lawsuits with states and municipalities suing them, right? And as part of that, we're getting a clearer picture of exactly how coordinated and exactly how undercutting, right, and frankly strategic some of that work was. And then I think the last thing is this question of what's the effect of that, right? And so I think Naomi Oreskes and others have been starting to ask, what is the effect of hearing denier messages all the time? And under what conditions would people be open to do exactly like Jack said, to reframe as not necessarily I'm a believer or a denier, but what part of this can I hook into as a winner?
So Jack, if you were going to enumerate the main points of the blueprint that you would want people to pick up if they scan through it, what would they be? Well, you do have an executive summary that people can reach on your website, but maybe they won't be doing that. They might be hiking right now and listening to this for some reason.
And this is not a surprise to you, but it's worth saying aloud that we do have evidence right around the time that Jack's talking about, as Inconvenient Truth is coming in, and as we see a lot of money being plugged into the denier sphere, right? We do have evidence from Bob Brule and Riley Dunlap that the denier message coming from conservative elites did in fact have an impact.
Of course it did. I mean, it's obvious that it did. Yeah.
Right. It's certainly obvious now, right? But it becomes trickier when we think about the fact that this has become so, that question that was once actually not part of the politicization question is now, right? So I guess in addition to everything that you're saying about the bad guys, we also have to contend with the fact that this is among the issues that have got swept up in partisan polarization.
Yeah, it is. And it's just another area where we're at tremendous risk to being governed by the wrong people.
In terms of like the big takeaways of the blueprint, when you look at what a coalition is, right, it's a collection of individuals that come from different places, different organizations, different perspectives, different political analyses, and you're trying to get them all to be going in the same direction, right, to share a vision. And often I feel like the vision can be shared, right? We want to stop this pipeline, or we want to get this piece of legislation through. And then the tactics may also be shared, but the strategy, the theories of change are often not shared. The how do we do that, right? The what makes this happen. And so coordination and communication can be really difficult. And when push comes to shove, when there is miscommunication or miscoordination or a lack of coordination between coalition partners, you run this risk of people getting frustrated and maybe shying away from the coalition, right? Or getting out of it, or ghosting, or soft exiting, or any of these other terms. And without the real kind of processes of, let's figure out why we're doing this and how we want to do this together and what we can bring to the table together. And so the big takeaway from the Blueprints project is how to have those structured conversations to deal with things like coordination, to deal with things like building relationships and building that relational kind of buffer such that when push comes to shove, when things get hard, we can trust in each other as individuals who can be comrades, who want to work in each other's best interests, and we don't have fears of, you know, backbiting or people crossing each other or harming each other in whatever ways. Just trying to basically be able to work through friction, work through tension, because that's always going to exist.
Lindsay, when you consider this space and the politics and the reality of the scientifically observable change that's going on, optimistic or pessimistic?
Realistic.
Yeah. Meaning what?
Well, I think part of what I think what excited me about the report is that there was actually good news. There both were specific, precise policy wins, and there were learnings that existed that we were capturing and sharing. I think one of the criticisms that has been fairly leveled across our movement is that for a while we were caught on our heels, that we had a very limited set of tools in our toolbox coming in particular into the 80s and 90s, and that we weren't very flexible and we weren't able to learn. And I think that you could really make the case in particular since Waxman-Markey that we have broadened the set of tools in our toolbox. We have started to ask pretty real, imperfect, but real and debatable questions about power. And then I think this other dimension, that the fact that the movement is so much richer, all of that point to more wins and more power.
Jack, why is this what you do with your life? There are so many things that you could be applying your skills to. You've been more than half a decade at this one organization. What's keeping you there? And do you think that's in your future for a long time?
Isn't the joke with like all advocates, all organizers, that we're trying to organize ourselves out of a job, right?
You got some work to do yet.
Yeah. For me personally, from like an ego perspective, like a sense of responsibility, maybe a sense of guilt of stepping away and taking the various skills and talents and experiences that have been invested in me and not using that to build climate power. There's this existential part, right, where it's climate change is happening and it could be really, really, really bad or really bad. I think we have a moral responsibility to each other to try to minimize that harm and to minimize the suffering that climate change can cause. And realizing, I think in terms of what Lindsay is saying, that we have a lot of resources and tools and things also in our favor. And it's a matter of putting those things together, making the most use of what is at hand, building out what we need, but we're not that far, or we don't have to be that far from the wins that we want, but we have to get some stuff in order first, probably.
So, Lindsay, you mentioned that you would like funders to see what was going on here. If you had a second to say a thing or two to that group, people who have money to deploy, who understand that there's a big problem, who want to have the most impact that they can have with those dollars and with their time, what would you tell them?
I would say, please don't underestimate the amount of capacity that is needed to actually build trust. I think we often think of trust in kind of a friendly, like, I'll learn to like them. And I think that's what we learned, is that some of these groups were talking, that were starting to talk about working together years before the actual campaign. And what that meant is that they were able to be honest and candid about times when trust might have been broken in the past, or being honest that, hey, I don't really know you from Eve. We need to build some trust. So trust takes a long time. The amount of front loading that the effective coalitions have to do with questions of governance, how are we going to make decisions, and relational culture, how are we going to work in this space together? And that's everything from as abstract as what do we mean by environmental justice to what in the hell do we do when one partner drops the ball, right? It became so clear to me over the course of this work that the more you can do of that ahead of time, the more prepared you'll be from the insane contingencies that all of us go through, right? And then the last one would be, don't forget that we have evidence that it is only when we have diverse coalitions for implementation that we see transformative change endure, right? And so it can't be the case that funders leave after a pipeline is either built or kept from being built, right? But that there is some infrastructure, like Jack says, there's some movement infrastructure that can actually be built and maintained, but that requires resources.
Jack, what should I have asked you that I have failed to?
What to do with the report? What to do with the knowledge that this exists?
Yeah, what should we do with the report and the knowledge that exists?
One of the big goals that we had coming into this from the lab perspective, and I think also from Lindsay's perspective, is that we didn't want this to be some kind of sterile piece of, you know, academic writing or white paper or whatever, or that just gets published, goes online, and then people say, oh yeah, great job, and then no one actually uses. So we want to put this in people's hands as something to be used, to be applied, to create the outcomes that we want. We're doing some of that at the lab side. So, you know, this is freely available on our website. And I'm happy to share the link again with you, Nathaniel, when this comes out. But we're putting out a training series about, hey, let's do some like one-on-one or small group like talking and doing about this, figuring out how to actually make this usable for folks, working through the workbook step by step, and, you know, like helping folks where they are with their coalitions or with their future coalitions. And that we're kicking off that that series in early April. These are openly available as long as you're a lab member, which is totally free. You know, very few barriers to get involved. So if you're interested in this, if you know, you listen to this and you're like, hey, I work in a coalition, we have some issues, I would love to hear about this and hear about maybe ways to improve these issues, please come to that training, come talk to us. We don't want this to be something that, you know, just sits on paper or somewhere.
I really do appreciate the chance to talk to both of you. Lindsay, is there anything else you want to say?
Let's just get really nerdy. And I think that in terms of the content that I would most want to push is this concept that sounds just absolutely tedious because it is. And that's questions around governance. I don't think the climate space has taken seriously questions of how we make decisions and if we are going to espouse values of equity, right, and contending with legacies of marginalization, then that has to be that there has to be a conversation about how we arrive at decisions. And that is tedious, exhausting, very difficult work, but the dividends that it pays are just very, very clear in the evidence.
Well, thank you both very much. That was Jack and Lindsay. They are at climateadvocacylab.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.